We all need spring. We need the thaw. And I want to suggest that that's true on a bunch of levels. And we felt when we walked out the door this morning. You know, there's the physical one. At 10:30, there were 3 people here. It's not a critique. There were a few more than that. Very few. Mike actually said something. He said something to the effect of, "Sunny day, nice day does not equal church." So, thank you all for coming. But there is something in us that just needs to respond to that change, you know? I think one of the levels at which that's true is a spiritual one. I think that one way to articulate what happens in and around our longing for spring is to connect it to spiritual longing, to longing for newness, longing for a landscape that appears to be frozen solid and completely dead to actually start to live again, you know, for something to happen out of that. But I think whether it's a physical winter or a spiritual winter, you know, by the time the end comes, we're dying for a new life. We just need it. I'm not sure how much you've been out and about the last couple of days, but it's been like an explosion. It's like somewhere there is an enormous garage, and it's just filled with all the accoutrements of summer. It's filled with motorcycles and bicycles and convertibles and shorts. And on some undetermined, mysterious signal, somebody rolls up the door, and it just kind of pours out into the street, you know, and it's your neighbor. the person you didn't know is your neighbor, right? The person that moved in January that you haven't seen yet. And all of a sudden, they're out there, and there's this sense about it. When you just walk around the city of, we've been waiting all winter for this, and it's here. Woo! Right? And it just happens. It just kind of explodes. What does all that have to do with spirituality and with the parable that we read together? Well, since what we read is a parable, I'm going to play a little bit fast and loose with some of the images. This is a curious parable because it's one for which Jesus offers his own interpretation of it in the text, which doesn't happen very often. But that said, it is in the nature of the parabolic story to behave differently in different settings. That's part of what makes a parable a parable. And so we're going to go with that as our permission. Jesus says, when he interprets this for the disciples, who are like, why bother with that story? He says that the seeds in the story are the word of God. And this is where I think lots of us get stuck in this parable. We're not even out of the gate, and we get hung up. And I think one of the reasons we get hung up is because, for a variety of reasons, when Jesus says that the seeds are the word of God, we hit our default concrete literalist button. And we conclude, without really chasing it down, that what Jesus means is the text of the Bible. The things that are written down and that claim to be, and that we hold to be, God's revelation. Jesus doesn't say that the seed in the parable are the words of God. He says they're the word of God. And the word that Jesus uses for word is not a static one. The word that Jesus uses for word is a dynamic one. What Jesus is talking about throughout the parable, when he talks about the word of God, is more like, think about it more like the voice of God. The noise God makes when God reveals God's self. The sound of God. The presence of God. The living, dynamic thing that when we encounter a being that is not us, we are encountering. If you've ever had a significant spiritual experience that was outside of your frame of typical reference, some occasion where you walked away and went, I think that might have been God. That's what we're talking about. And I'm not just referring to the ecstatic. I'm not just referring to you charismatics. That was funny, Dave. I'm not sure about you guys, you know. Anyway. I'm talking about any moment in our life where we have a sense that God is not just an idea, but an actual living being that is not like us. However that comes to us, and it comes to us in so many different ways, when that comes to us, that is what Jesus is talking about when he talks about the Word of God. If we start into the parable thinking of the Word of God as something God sent, that we received, and that transaction is all done, and now all that's left to sort out is whether we will go down path A or path B with what's been handed to us, we are going to miss most of what Jesus is trying to say. Because when it comes to our longing for spring, when it comes to our longing for new life, to our spiritual seeking, we're not actually looking for something static. We're not looking for a new idea. We're actually doing a Mika. We've got our nose to the ground, and we are sniffing to try to find the new living thing that comes up through the dead landscape and says to us, it won't always be winter. It's spring. New life is going to come. It's going to come where we don't expect it. It's going to come in a way that we can't cause and we can't stop. And that's why we feel hopeful. Because in the end, if it was up to us, we would have folded shop in January. We're looking for something that is going to emerge against all the odds. And so it's important to think of this idea of the Word of God as something that's alive, that's active in the present tense, even if, and this is important, even if it looks and feels like there's nothing going on. Now, if we were going to put that set of ideas into the context of our recent conversations about beginning at the beginning, it might be helpful to think of this as being out there exploring, and this is why I did the video thing with Mika, because when I take her outside, dogs can smell about 12 million more things than we can, more or less, in terms of the nuance of scent. And her little cute little nose is vibrating outside at this time of the year. It's just like, it's just like this little tuning fork thing everywhere she goes. Just constant, right? That's more like, I think, what's going on in our spirits when we are looking for the thing that we are calling this morning a spiritual spring. We are quivering with the possibilities. We're not quite finding what we're looking for, but we're not giving up either, because there is something in the air, there is something in the scents that are buried in the debris of winter that keep us looking. That keep us, you know, following our nose. And so we take to the road, we go exploring. And when we go out there exploring, we find all sorts of things that call for our attention. And they may or may not be the thing that we were trying to find. They may or may not be the thing that is helpful, the thing that will actually lead us to the new life that got us out there sniffing around, looking for it in the first place. And so in lots of ways, I think to kind of keep Mika as our frame of reference, there's a progression when we're out there exploring spiritually. And you kind of watched her do it, right? It starts with sniffing around. That's pretty benign. It's pretty safe. Unless you stick your nose right into a mud puddle, which she did actually earlier this spring. It was very funny. But unless you actually do something stupid, which even for a dog that was, you're not going to get yourself in too much trouble. You know, just kind of, right? I mean, it's a pretty casual sort of exploration of the possibilities. But what you watched what Mika did when all of a sudden there was like, hey, that's a new smell.
The one that was about the bubble gum behind the rock, right? It was like kind of beep, 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 beep. And then she just kind of falls until she finds the thing that she's sensing is there. This is different. This is new. Maybe this is it. Maybe this is the thing I came out here to find. And then when she finds it, what does she do? Well, she sniffs it closer. And when she's kind of satisfied that it's not going to jump up and bite her on the nose or whatever it is that her two-year-old doggy brain is afraid of, then she goes to the next level and she gives it a lick. And if it's still not causing a lot of problems, then she puts it in her mouth and gives it a good chew. And then sometimes she spits it out. Sometimes she swallows it and then spits it out later. We won't talk about that too much. That's really ugly. What happens? And sometimes she just consumes it. It's like, there we go. That's nourishing, and I'm going to take that in, and it's going to turn into energy, and I'm going to be super meek. This parable, I think, can legitimately be a bit of a screen for our spiritual exploration, for our sniffing around. I think there's ways in which this is the kind of story that can help us discern what some of the false scents of spring are, what the things that we might encounter that look like what we're looking for but aren't it. How to kind of discern some of that. And because it's a parable, one of the things we get to do is we get to kind of sit our story into this story. That's the way parables work. They're like a good poem or a good song. We weren't there when it happened to whoever wrote it, but when we hear it, we sort of feel like, oh yeah, I could have been. The first part of the parable, this is intriguing to me, the first part of the story as Jesus tells it to these people is about getting crushed. So think about it this way. If we're on a spiritual quest for a spiritual spring, for new life, for hope, what sort of things on a quest like that feel like the stuff that falls onto the road and gets stomped? To put it another way, when do you and I feel spiritually stepped on? What makes you feel, have you ever had an experience that has caused you to feel like you were right on the edge of something that could be good spiritually, something that could be rich, something that could alter life, and then it just got flattened? For me, one of the ways this happens is when I encounter people that are completely intractable. Maybe you've had this experience. You're in a conversation with somebody and there's something behind their eyes that says to you, I know the answers to all the questions. I have this wired. My answers are not negotiable. I'm going to use this language advisedly. My answers are not negotiable because they are true. If yours are not like mine, they are not true. This is not actually, what we're having here is not actually a dialogue. What we're having here is actually the kind of conversation where you reveal your question and I answer it correctly. And you either receive or take off. If you see it my way, you're in. If you don't, you're out. And you know what that's like? Have you had those conversations? It's hard to sustain them graciously, I find. Which is a challenge of mine. I'm not saying that that's legitimate. It's just that's how it feels. I want to become intractable about intractability in those moments. I want to say something like, never mind what I want to say. What feels like happens inside of me in moments like that, and maybe inside of you, is that I feel like I was sitting in a conversation about spiritual things, and they're not that easy to come by, those conversations. They're a little rare. And they can be so lovely. And it's, there's kind of one starting to happen. And I'm starting to get to know a layer of this person, an inside of this person's life and spirit and essence. And there's a sense of we have something in common that is so fantastic. And this is the bug in the windshield moment, you know? That's just so over. And something dies. It's easy, I think, to come away from an encounter like that feeling like we should give up the search, feeling like we should abandon hope. It's interesting, you know, I think a lot of times, at least in my experience, I have those encounters with people who presuppose, in the name of religious commonality, that them and I think or believe the same way because we are in the same environment, or maybe even because we have a really significant spiritual quest in common. And it can happen really easily in a place like this, like the table. Because this is we state that we are a community that's on about spirituality. And more particularly, it's not a mystery that this is a community that is on about Christian spirituality. And I think it's easy sometimes for us as humans to assume that the story that we call Christianity, the one that we grew up with, the one that we espouse, the one that we feel like we understand a little bit about or identify with, that that's the same one that everybody that uses that language, a follower of Jesus, espouses. That if we have that much in common, we have everything in common. And it's not true. It's just not. But sometimes, when we encounter that way of thinking, and it crushes us, the easiest conclusion to come to is that the thing we're sniffing around for, the sense that we have that there's new life out there somewhere, if we could only find it, is what ends up getting flattened. It's what ends up getting crushed on the road. The second image in the parable, this image of seeds falling in the gravel and springing up quickly and then dying out just as quickly. You ever wonder what would happen to Christendom if the power went out? Like the electricity? The AC? Do you ever wonder if we could sustain, broadly speaking, in the Western Christian realm, do you ever wonder if we could sustain belief without light shows and smoke machines and big-ass PAs? Do you ever wonder if we could do that? Ever wonder how come we seem to need a flavor of the month worship song industry? It doesn't take very many moments of honest conversation in any city, certainly in this city, to know which churches are trending. And this is not a commentary on trending churches in particular. As Christians, we're a varied bunch, and we need a wide variety of expressions because we're a wide variety of people in the thing called the church. That's one of the wonders of it. But it is meant to offer us a moment of self-critique about treating the thing we're calling a search for new life the same way we would treat any other trend. This part of the parable could be understood as a moment in the story that is about buy cheap, get cheap spirituality. If what we come to the story for is to be pumped up, then this is our chapter in the story. Because we can get that. We can go shopping until we find an encounter with a version of this thing that pumps us up. And we can go to that once a week and get our shot, and then we go back out there and we kind of run on until the inertia kind of runs down. Must be Saturday. Time to get pumped up again. We can go get it. We can go out and get juiced about Jesus, you know? And I'm not even arguing that that's a problem unless we mistake it for the thing that we actually came looking for. This is like thinking that a can of Red Bull is a meal. This is sugar buzz spirituality. Can you get some energy from a can of Red Bull? Yep. It'll make you feel like Atticus's hair looks. Wah! I love that kid's hair. Anyway, he's been looking at me like this the whole time, and I just had to respond. You are awesome, boy. But when it dies, spirituality that gives us a buzz and then leaves us with a deficit is not the thing that our souls are hungry for. When it's firing on all its cylinders, that kind of spirituality can feel like the thing that our soul is hungry for. It can feel a lot like what our soul is hungry for. But look around. Look around at the way spring works. It doesn't work like that. The seed in this story that falls into the weeds is pretty self-explanatory, at least in context. We think we've found the path to new life, to the spring of our spiritual seasons, and then the details of life take over and what we thought we were on about gets choked out. And in a culture like ours that places such an enormous value on certain understandings of what a good life is, this is so easy to fall into and so hard to resist. But what about the other side of the story? What about the seeds that grow? What do those have to teach us? What is it that characterizes the green stuff that is poking up through the dead stuff? I got this friend who's a farmer, he's a commercial farmer, he's a big outfit, lots of machines, thousands of acres and all that business. Really thoughtful, engaged guy. And he farms in no small part because he loves the earth. And when he wants to feel like he's connected to what he's on about, he gets down off this enormous 4-speaker air-conditioned behemoth of a tractor and stands on the dirt and kicks it with his toe to see how it's doing. And then once he sees what the top layer is like, he gets down on his knees in the dirt and he sticks his fingers in it, runs it through his hand, and then he comes home and talks about what he felt. And then he makes multi-million dollar decisions. That connection to the earth. So this is the guy that I ask when I have questions about growing things or things that aren't growing very well. And things that aren't growing very well would often include my back lawn. And so I remember a couple of years ago, I asked Peter, I said, you know what, I want to do some infill, some repair seeding here. And I'm just wondering, how does that work? I put this stuff out there. Is it going to take root? Do I need to rip it all up and till it? And like, what do I need to do to kind of make this work? And he kind of gave me this little mini-seminar on seeds. And one of the things that he talked about in that conversation has never left me. He said, you know what? You could take a seed, and you could go out there, and they were visiting, and so we were looking out the back window at the lawn, and it was the middle of winter. Whole yard was covered in snow and ice. He said, you could take a handful of seeds, and you could go out there to where you know the dead patch is, and you could seed it. You could just put the seeds on the top of the snow. And if they actually stayed there and they went down to, you know, vertically to where you laid them, so they actually landed where you wanted them to, they would grow in the spring. You could put them out there in the middle of the winter, in the spring, they would grow. I was just about enough to make me, like, put on my snow boots and go seed the thing, you know? But that's fantastic. Like, how? He says, they're just that tenacious. Seeds are just that tenacious. And he said, grass, in particular, has this about it, that it will self-seed. It will just kind of keep trying to make this work. It'll keep trying to grow. It'll keep trying to find a way to come up out of what you think is the dead zone. Seeds, if you've ever looked at them at all, they just look dead. They are inert. There is nothing about the exterior of that thing called a seed that says life to me. My head might know that that's what's going on, but all the other senses are kind of like, this is dust. This is a lump of dirt. This is inert. There's nothing here that's about new life. But there is some peculiar aspect of the way that seeds work that keeps my hope alive. Literally, when I put them in the ground and hope they'll turn into a better looking lawn. Spiritually, when I'm looking for new life. And Jesus talked about this. And it's a really curious thing. He talked about it this way in John 12. He said, very truly I tell you,
Unless a kernel of wheat falls to the ground and dies, it remains only a single seed, but if it dies, it produces many seeds. In other words, it comes to life. Okay, wait a minute. I thought we were talking about new life. And now you just sucker punch me with a conversation about death.
We've probably all heard enough sermons about dying to the self, presented in ways that make us just want to run from the building screaming. Or that just descend on us like a cloud of guilt and failure. And maybe equal the same result, but we want to crawl from the building whimpering instead of run screaming. And I think that's often a result of a similar loss of perspective on the greater story to the one that we ran into right at the beginning of this parable. We do have this tendency to think of life in either-or terms. And we have that same tendency when it comes to thinking about an idea like dying to live. We kind of go, that's not just an oxymoron. That's a barrier. That's a spiritual barrier. I am not interested in pursuing a spiritual path that says to me early on, you have to die to live. Why? Partly because we think of dying to live as an either-or issue. We think it's an oxymoron or a contradiction or something in that realm. And that's partly because we think that life is what we see. We think that we can understand the way the spiritual equation of life works by observing it the way we observe everything else. But that's like thinking that it's no sense putting a seed in the ground because when we hold it up in front of us and look at it, it looks like a dried up husk and there's nothing there that has anything to do with new life. It's short-sighted. It actually requires dynamic imagination to believe that there is something going on here that is bigger than what I can observe, that is more profound than what I can cause, that I can't stop it, I can't start it, I'm actually not responsible for it. It's not in my realm. But I live with it. And it is the mystery that this whole story is about. And that mystery, as Jesus tries to sum it up, has something to do with being willing to believe that if I'll put into the ground, figuratively speaking, if I'll put into the spiritual quest this whole husk, this whole thing that I am, and it can look and feel as dried up and dead as the seeds that we pulled out of some 2,000-year-old Egyptian tomb and planted and they came up. But if I take that thing, if I take that thing and I am willing to actually put it into the story in a way that says this is all or nothing, what's going to come from that is life. Is that life latent in the seed, whether I put it in the ground or not? Yes, it is. And that's part of the goodness of the story, right? It's not like I get one shot at this decision. The seed holds that capacity. I hold that capacity to come to life, to live the way that God made me to live, always. Because that's how the Maker who put it there made me. It's always there. Whether it blossoms, whether it becomes not just life for me, but life for those around me, whether it becomes part of an ecosystem of life, has to do with whether I somehow mysteriously, and this is of course where the analogy kind of fails because I'm putting myself in the ground, right? But this is where I get to choose whether I'm going to actually engage with this mystery or not. This is where I get to try to discern whether I'm at that moment of investing this thing or whether I'm going to just keep sniffing around. It's thinking about this whole idea of giving up to live as being an experience that takes me to a place that I can't really handle. Think about the death in this story as more like the kind of language that we use when we're talking about something that takes us over. Have you ever had any kind of an emotional experience, any kind of a personal experience where your words just weren't working when you tried to describe it later? It was like, you know, we kind of break down, right? We can't find a way to articulate it. Love does that to us. Grief does that to us. Beauty does that to us. Awfulness does that to us. The extremities of the human experience,
do this to us. When we get to the edges of what we can manage, we bump into something that has a kinship to the thing that Jesus is talking about here when he talks about death.
Think about that image of seed going into the ground and dying and bringing life, not just from itself, but this whole system around it. Think about that image of dying as a picture of being taken to the edge of what we can control and manage, and then past it into a different realm.
And that's what Jesus is talking about. That might all, in the end, sound a little bit crazy. Maybe I am. Maybe it is. Maybe Jesus was. But what I want to leave us with this morning is this question. If you think about that story this way, if you sit with this story that way, does it have the scent of new life? Does it have the savor of spring? That's not a question to answer like that, perhaps. But it might be one of those things that, like Mika's little exploration this morning, takes us outside of the yard that we know. It takes us beyond the bounds of the way we've thought about this before. It takes us outside the gate. And I'm not sure I'm pleased with Mika's conclusion about leaving the home she's from and taking to the road and not coming back. I think there's something very important about home in this metaphor, but I also think there's something enormously important about the idea of exploring, of saying, I need to go somewhere I haven't gone before, because that's where the scent of hope is taking me, because that's where the savor of the thing that my soul says is possible, of new life, that's where it's taking me. Not back to the familiar, but to somewhere I haven't been, to somewhere mysterious, to somewhere where there are things that happen that are bigger than what I can cause or stop.